on the one side, there's this thing, and on the other side, there's the Vaishnava side of things. Now, to be a real Vaishnava means you're beyond the whole system, and you're transcendental to even the mode of goodness. You don't see sufficient goodness around yet. But if you want to be a Vaishnava, then some of the things you're doing as a Vaishnava on that system of spiritual advancement is things that are following the Pancharatrika Vidhi, which is deity worship. For that you need brahminical initiation. So for that you will get brahminical initiation in order properly to worship the deities and so on like that. But even so, you may be functioning in one of these other categories as a matter of occupational duty before you're transcendental to the modes of material nature. That's my understanding. If we are just working on the Bhagavata Vidhi, then there's no need for brahminical initiation. This brahminical initiation was introduced by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Anyway, to make a point. But Prabhupada also describes it as just part of the Pancharatrika Vidhi process, the process which involves us in performing deity worship. And also we perform other Vedic rites. I mean, we also use the Brahma Gayatri mantra also. So that just seems to me as a kind of another track that's going alongside this one. And as a result of that, one will gradually become established in the mode of goodness. Although, you know, until then you have to act according to one of these things. But even then, even if you're established in the mode of goodness and are qualified to be a brahmana, still, for the sake of teaching others, you may well act in one of these other capacities still without being thought of as conditioned in that way. That's my understanding. This is a thing on which probably people have different ideas, I would guess. Anyway, that's how I figured it out so far. That can change.
Mm-hmm. I would be curious about your speculation for the future.
Oh, well, okay. We'll have to end this. Maybe I turn off the tapes and the cameras. Again, it's this love of, symmetry. But the last 500 years was going down. And then we see already what you're getting is the Vaishyas are coming back in a big way. So imagine, you know, a couple of multinational corporations or a few of them start to know everything, start to run everything. And these Vaishyas also, you know, right now, they're these armies for hire that work for them. Who pays the paychecks to the military? Because they all get paychecks. That means actually they're functioning as employees of the Vaishyas. So let's assume that somehow or other, because of what the Vaishyas are doing, social chaos starts to result. Like, for example, if there's too much concentration of wealth and too few hands, economic activity will start to get paralyzed. There's just no more money. Everybody, you know, few people have the money, and what's going to happen? There's no more markets or anything like that. And, you know, then I think what will happen is that you may start to get depressions and hyperinflations, and you're going to start to get all kinds of economic and social chaos. Also, like right now, everything is going on because factory labor is being exported to poor and poorer countries. What happens when you run out of poor countries? You know, you notice, by the way, there's a really nice highway now that goes through, four-lane highway being built from Delhi to Vrindavan and on to Agra. You know who's funding that highway?
No.
Financing? The Japanese. Why would the Japanese finance a highway? Because look what's growing up alongside those highways. Factories. Dark satanic mills. And Vrindavan's gentle green. Uh-huh. That's right. So that's for the exportation of the cheap labor. So what happens when you've done that?
Machines.
You run out, huh?
Replacing with machines.
Uh-huh.
With machines.
No, you still need labor to do that, all that kind of work, you know. They're the tribal machines. Well, then what will happen, like in the United States, you're going to find, like, you know, like the center city of the United States, you have basically third world countries. And so they'll put the factories there next, and they'll say, you know, we want to build a factory here in the middle of Detroit or the middle of Philadelphia, but, you know, we can't do it unless we can have a special concession. We don't have to pay the people this much and so on, the other thing, and, you know, it'll start to get I think social tensions will start to develop. And anyway, somehow or other, I believe the vices will blow it. And then you'll get tyrants. The military guys will come in, the strongman, the Idi Amin types, you know, these tyrants. Military leaders who are just, you know, commanding forces. And, you know, when they hold some territory for a while, then they become called government. It's basically crimps on a large scale. And when organized crime becomes successful, it's called government. So you'll get these kind of things. Now, the next step, and this is where it gets really speculative, is that ISKCON gets itself together. And actually has a real class of brahmanas. And somewhere along the line, some of these people who become kshatriyas in this way listen to the brahmanas. And anyway, so that's a torch. It's a fantasy, right? Fantasy and science fiction. Anyway, you ask, so I... Okay, now let's do something serious and catch the tail end of Archie anyway. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. In the sequence of the presentation, we really have to discuss just the general notion and principles of hierarchy. And that means going over this material from C.I. Lewis in his preface to Paradise Lost, and also there's an excerpt from Shakespeare. Some of you just got the material. Some of you may have not read it yet. Some English-speaking devotees said they found it hard going. So I imagine those of you who first language is in English may have an even harder time. So I'll try to go through it anyway, kind of slowly, because I think it's good for broadening our horizons, that we see that so many ideas that we are getting from Prabhupada turn out to be the kind of common notion of things in the world and in Europe, you know, up until a few hundred years ago. And I talked about this here. I gave a couple of sessions about some years ago, I think in 91 or 92, on modern historical consciousness. And we talked then about some of the these principles of hierarchy. And I thought I'd start by quoting a few things from that talk. Forgive me for quoting myself. Sometimes it's faster. I happen to have up here on the computer there. Those lectures I gave, oh, it's not going to stand up, is it? On modern historical consciousness were rewritten and printed in the Communications Journal. So we have this English word hierarchy, which I had trouble spelling. As you see, it comes from two Greek words, this word hieros, which means holy or sacred, and arche, which means order, origin, rule, or order, rule or order, or sacred rule. And you really can trace it back in European thought to Plato, and of course in his student Aristotle also. Becomes a standard way of looking at things all through the Christian period and up until about the 18th century when things began to fall apart. So, according to this idea, the structure of reality is hierarchy, a divine order, with God at the top, and the origin or the cause. And from this origin, the absolute, the rest of reality proceeds in the form of ordered, graded steps going further distant away from the absolute, And each step further from the origin brings a unit decrease in being or power or value. At the top, you have the ultimate perfection, the most perfect being. Then you move down through all gradations, and at the very bottom, there's chaos or just lifeless matter. For example, according to the theology which was started from an influential book by Dionysius the Areopagite, there's God, and then there's the order of the angels, nine ranks of angels, seraphim, cherubim, throne, dominions, virtues, powers, principalities, archangels, and angels. You see, they're ranked like that. Just like in the military, they have their rank, you know, lieutenant, captain, major, colonel, general, and so on, in the same way. And then, of course, in medieval theology, each rank of angels was responsible for running a different level of the planets, or spheres. The orbits of the planet were thought to be spheres in which the planets moved around the descending order of spheres to the fixed Earth. At the outer edge was Aristotle called the primum mobile, which imparts motion to the spheres below. And then after the primum mobile, you get the fixed stars and Saturn, Jupiter, Mars, Sun, Venus, Mercury, and Moon. So anyway, this hierarchical principle, it's there in the stars, and then it turns out to be mirrored everywhere else. It's one hierarchy within another hierarchy within another hierarchy. Or, as they say, the microcosm is a map of the macrocosm. So they reflect each other. So there's a mirroring. So that each category of being neatly reflects the order of the whole. Hierarchies nested within hierarchies. As God is the supreme among all beings, so the king is supreme among human beings. Who's the king of the beasts? The lion, of course, we all know that. And who is the king among the birds? The eagle, right. So how do we know this stuff? And among fish? Europe said the dolphins. I don't know what Brahman said. Who's the dolphin? Among minerals, what is the highest? Gold, of course, the immutable metal. And among elements is ether. And so in this way, everything is ranked like that. And so this way you can see, if you've understood this, you can see how neat and orderly and together creation is by this system of hierarchy. In the 18th century, it's still being talked about. The English Pope Alexander a Pope, he had a poem called Essay on Man. And in that poem, these lines appear. Vast chain of being, which from God began, nature's ethereal, human, angel, man, beast, bird, fish, insect, what no eye can see. Meaning going from one down to the microscopic. No glass can reach from infinite to thee. That is you, a human being, from infinite to thee, from thee to nothing. And so he expresses this idea. Here's another discussion. Going back 13 centuries before Alexander Pope, here's a 5th century Christian writer. He says, since from the supreme God mind arises, and from mind soul, these are Neoplatonic notions, and since this in turn creates all subsequent things and fills them all with life, and since the single radiance illuminates all and is reflected in each, the single radiance being the absolute truth, as a single face might be reflected in many mirrors placed in a series, And since all things follow in continuous succession, degenerating in sequence to the very bottom of the series, the attentive observer will discover a connection of parts from the Supreme God down to the last dregs of things, mutually linked together and without a break. All this is Homer's golden chain, which God, he says, made hang down from heaven to earth. This is a reference to a story in Homer. So that's an idea of the chain of being. Now, let me just look at this material now, and the one I have here disappeared. Oh. Yeah, I have to look on somebody else. I wish I had it memorized. In this preface to Paradise Lost by C.S. Lewis, I just found one of the better short descriptions of this hierarchical conception that I've ever run across. He's trying to make Milton's poem intelligible to modern people. And he says we have a hard time understanding it because we implicitly, automatically reject the ideas on which the whole poem is based, this hierarchical conception of life. So you'll see here, he starts with a complaint by Samuel Johnson that Milton thought men made only for rebellion and women only for obedience. This is because Milton himself, at one time there was a revolution against the king in England led by Oliver Cromwell, and Milton was of Cromwell's party. And so Milton was part of a rebellious faction against the king. And yet in Paradise Lost, he's very much in favor of order and hierarchy and everything. So this is the particular issue that our author here is dealing with, is to show how this is not inconsistent. But we're not so much concerned about Milton as we are with the general idea. So here, if you start looking at the second paragraph, he wants to talk about what he calls Milton's central thought. It's right down the last words in the first paragraph. Milton's central thought. He says, this thought is not peculiar to Milton. It belongs to the ancient orthodox tradition. This is a nice phrase. It's very old, and it's orthodox. Tradition of European ethics from Aristotle to Johnson himself, the 18th century critic of Milton. And a failure to understand it entails a false criticism, not only of Paradise Lost, but of nearly all literature before the Revolutionary Period. Revolutionary Period means American and French revolutions. That may be called, this is the central thought, the hierarchical conception. According to this conception, degrees of value are objectively present in the universe. And mostly now what modern thought is that this is the universe only consists of facts. And values it comes from the fact that some things we like and some things we dislike. They're just our reaction. So there's a world of facts, and human and values are placed on them by us, by value judgments. But according to the hierarchical conception, values are out there. They're objectively present in the universe. Values are a kind of a fact, ultimately. Everything, now here's the hierarchical conception, everything except God has some natural superior. Everything except unformed matter has some natural inferior. The goodness, happiness, and dignity of every being consists in obeying its natural superior and ruling its natural inferior. So everyone's placed somewhere except for God. Every one of us has got a superior and an inferior. And of course, unformed matter, that has no inferior. But so we're somewhere in this rank, and every one of us, without exception, has a superior and an inferior. So our well-being, our happiness, our dignity, our goodness, consists in our truly being what we are, taking that place in the chain, and obeying the natural superior, and ruling the natural inferior. That's what he says here. When it, that is something in the chain, fails in either part of this twofold task, we have disease or monstrosity in the scheme of things until the peccant being is either destroyed or corrected. Peccant means sinful, out of order. Like Latin, peccavi, I have sinned, you know. One or the other, that is either destroyed or corrected, it will certainly be. For by stepping out of its place in the system, whether stepping up like a rebellious angel, an angel trying to become God, that's Satan, right? Or down like an uxorious husband, uxorious means excessively fond of or controlled by one's wife. Ux is the Latin word for wife. U-X, ux. So, like an uxorious husband. Prabhupada uses the word henpecked for this one. It's not anyway, that's the way English goes in India. So, by stepping out of its place in the system, by stepping up or going down, it has made the very nature of things its enemy. It cannot succeed. So once you go out of order, all creation goes through big changes to restore this natural hierarchical order. Now, in the next paragraph, he talks about the way Aristotle deals with this hierarchical conception in the realm of politics. And it gets a little complicated, but I think what he says is that Aristotle says there are different kinds of rule. We talked about rule of the superior over the inferior and obedience of the inferior to the superior. Aristotle points out, he says, there are as many kinds of rule as there are kinds of superiority or inferiority. Thus a man should rule his slaves despotically. This Aristotle's politics has a infamous defense of slavery. I should admit that. His children monarchically, his wife politically. A soul should be the despot of the body, but reason the constitutional king of the passion. So that the justice or injustice of any given instance of rule depends wholly on the nature of the parties, not in the least on any social contract. When the citizens are really equal, that is, natural equals, then they ought to live in a republic where all rule in turn. This is Aristotle's idea. If they are not really equal, then the republican form becomes unjust. The difference between a king and a tyrant does not turn exclusively on the fact that one rules mildly and the other harshly. A king is one who rules over his real natural inferiors. He who rules permanently without successor over his natural equals is a tyrant, even if he rules well. He is inordinate, that is to say, out of order. Justice means equality for equals and inequality for unequals. So this is the Aristotelian idea. And then he goes on and discuss how the hierarchical conception goes on to apply to the universe as the whole, and where obedience and rule were found everywhere, and is not exactly a matter of metaphor. And then after that, he discusses this hierarchy, and he quotes, there's a very famous speech in a play by Shakespeare, which I've included, which sums up the hierarchical conception. And I guess we can go through this speech. It's here, page 1847. This is Trollius and Cressida. Beginning with line 85. This is, of course, old-fashioned English, which is even harder to understand. But here the editors have helpfully supplied, you know, current meanings for the words on the border, and also footnotes for things that are even more obscure. And of course, it's gorgeous English. I mean, you can't beat Shakespeare for sheer beauty. Huh? So here in this speech, Ulysses says, "The heavens themselves, the planets, and this center, meaning the earth, observe degree, priority, and place, in fixture, that is being fixed, course, proportion, season, form, office, and custom, all in line of order." So everything that is done according to a rule. And the whole universe is run by this rule. And he mentions degree and line of order. So that's the hierarchical conception. "And therefore is the glorious planet soul," that is the sun, "in noble eminence enthroned and sphered," because, hey, the sun is the king of the planets. Right? What we learn from the Brahma Samhita. "Enthroned and sphered amidst the other planets, the rest of them, whose medicinable eye," the sun's eye, "is medicinable," that is, it cures diseases. "Whose medicinable eye corrects the ill aspects of planets." Ill aspects means bad conjunctions. The ill aspects of planets evil, that is, you know, Saturn and, you know, those planets, Ketu and so on, "and posts," runs or hastens, goes fast, "like the commandment of a king, sans check, without check, to good and bad." So this is the sun who generally keeps order among the planets. But sometimes, when the planets in evil mixture to disorder wander, that is to say, as it says in the footnote, the planets, when they form bad conjunctions, "what plagues and portents," portents means ill omens, "what mutiny and rebellions, what raging of the sea, shaking of the earth, commotion in the wind, frights, changes here means political strife, horrors, divert," and shove aside, "and crack, rend means to tear, and deracionate," a deracionate is uproot, pull up by the roots, "deracionate the unity and married calm of states quite from their fixture." So it's saying that when the heavens are out of order, then things on earth is out of order. Well, we heard that before. So he says, oh, when degree is shaped. Degree means things in their proper hierarchical order. Which is the ladder to all high designs. The enterprise is sick. So if you want to do anything and do it well, there has to be everyone observing the proper degree. Otherwise, the enterprise, what you're trying to do, is sick. How could communities, we're talking about community, right? It says, how could communities, degrees in school, schools, meaning academic rank, professor, assistant professor, and so on, and brotherhoods in cities, brotherhoods means guilds, we'd say labor unions now, but in the medieval times, you know, the guilds had, there was quite a ceremony of rank. How could communities, degrees in schools, and brotherhoods in cities, peaceful commerce from dividable shores, shores separated by water, peaceful commerce from dividable shores, the primogeniture, that where the oldest son inherits the property, the Christ, right, primogenity and due of birth, prerogative of age, that is when you're old, you have certain, you do certain respect, so prerogative of age, crowns, scepters is the what a king holds, you know, a staff of, laurels, you know, a wreath given to a poet or something, but by degree stand in authentic place. So if there wasn't any degree, every piece of authority or greatness in society would be destroyed. Take but degree away, untune that string, and hark what discord follows. In other words, now it's like a guitar or something that's out of tune, and it's discord, unharmonious noise. Each thing meets in mere oppugnancy. Shakespeare must have made that word up. Oppugnancy means total antagonism. Huh? Each thing meets in total oppugnancy. Says, the bounded waters should lift their bosoms higher than the shores. And this is it. You know, the waters go higher than the land, and make a sop of this, of all this solid globe. Sop means, he says, a lump of soaked bread. And make a sop of all this solid globe. Strength should be the lord of imbecility. He means mere strength. Somebody who's just has physical strength would now lord it over anyone who happens to be physically weaker. And the rude son should strike his father dead. The father, the son is the natural subordinate of the father, but now the son is young and strong, the father is old, and bang. That's what would happen. Force should be right, Shakespeare says, or rather right and wrong, between whose endless jar, jar means shaking up of forces, justice resides, between these clashing forces, should lose their names, that is, right or wrong should lose their names, and so should justice too. Whereas right now he's saying the only thing that will matter is sheer force. And everything includes itself in power. Everything just comes down sheerly to power, that's all. Power into will. In Elizabethan English, the word will meant self-assertion, but it also meant sexual desire. And everything includes itself into power, turns into power. Power into will into appetite, and appetite, a universal wolf, so doubly seconded with will and power, must make perforce a universal prey, and at last eat up himself. In other words, you're just going to devour everything, including itself. This anticipates the philosophy of one Schopenhauer. The will sinks its teeth into itself. Thank Agamemnon this chaos, when degree is suffocated or blocked off, follows the choking, again the blocking off of degree. And this neglection of degree, it is that by a pace goes backwards in a purpose it hath to climb. In other words, you're thinking you're going forward, but you end up going backwards whenever you neglect this proper degree. The generals disdain by him one step below. So here the general at the top, he's using the army as an example, and the next one below him, say the colonel, he no longer respects the general. He by the next. Then everybody will say, well, the colonel doesn't respect the general, why should I respect the colonel? The major says. And the next by him beneath. So it just like falls down one after the other. So every step, exampled by the first pace that is sick of his superior, grows to an envious fever of pale and bloodless emulation. Emulation means envy. And it is this fever that keeps Troy on foot standing, not her own sinews. To end the tale of length, Troy in our weakness lives not in her strength. And so Nestor says, most wisely hath Ulysses here discovered, that is shown, revealed, the fever of whereof all our power is sick. So anyway, that's all we need to look at. This is the famous speech of Ulysses, in which is set out this idea of universal hierarchy and the idea of chaos that falls. Even if one, anywhere there's somebody out of order, then the whole thing can tend to collapse. And if you look at Shakespeare, this idea of hierarchy, he says, is presumed everywhere, and unless you accept it, you won't understand. He mentions the famous play Taming of the Shrew, which modern people can't understand at all, because there's a woman who's supposed to be obeying her natural superior, her husband, but is not. He mentions here in one play, that's The Tempest, the sage Prospero. The father, when the daughter is trying to give instruction to the father says, "What? I say, my foot, my tutor?" You're out of place. Now it goes on. Here I'm at the last paragraph of page 76. He gives various examples from Shakespeare. Now, if once the conception of hierarchy is fully grasped, we see that order can be destroyed in two ways. By ruling or obeying natural equals, that is to say, by tyranny or civility. In other words, when one natural equal rules over his other natural equal, then it is tyranny. And if I obey someone who is my natural equal, that is servility, being servile, being improperly subordinate, and say servility, like a slave. But it's false humility kind of a thing. And so that, and two, by failing to obey a natural superior or to rule a natural inferior, that is rebellion or remissness, that's the word he uses. So I have my natural superior, and I don't obey my natural superior, and that is rebellion. If I have a natural inferior, and I don't give that natural inferior guidance or instruction, then I am remiss. That is to say, I have not done my duty. I'm negligent of my duty. That is remission. If you look at it, we have, I guess, at least the one hierarchical relation we mostly all accept is between a spiritual master and a disciple. Right? So, If the disciple doesn't follow the order of the spiritual master, then that's out of order. That's rebellion. If the spiritual master doesn't give instruction or direction to the disciple, then that's remission. Remissness, he calls it, negligence of my duty, my proper duty in this. So there's two ways. Again, there's tyranny, ruling over somebody who's my natural equal. I have no business, but still I'm trying to lord it over others to whom I have no business doing that. And he says that's tyranny. When I allowed myself to be so ruled over by someone who has no business doing it, then that's servility. So there's two ways, going up, going down, and going up, that you can be out of order. So then he goes into saying that for Milton to obey God and reject King Charles II is not out of order, because in this case the question is Charles II really the natural superior or not? He may have the title and costume and office of a king, but is he really a king? And if somebody like Milton says no, then it wouldn't be out of order. It wouldn't really be rebellion, but rather be the rejection of tyranny. Then there's a couple of analysis of a couple of passages in Paradise Lost, which I will skip over for the time being, because it's now what this discusses is the fact that Satan, by rebelling against God on the one side, has now become a tyrant on the other side. As soon as he is no longer the servant of God, then his rule over others is not his natural rule anymore, but rather becomes a tyranny. He points this out. Let me see where else I want to go over something. And speaking about mentions here on page 79 that Milton delights in the ceremonious interchange of unequal courtesies. The ceremonious interchange of unequal courtesies. To really experience this kind of thing anymore, we have to go to India to see what's called etiquette, sadacharya, how people act in hierarchical relationships. The only place really, if you go to India, you can still see at least the remnants of a hierarchical culture. Of course, it's also in a distorted form now, but still, people are very careful. So the way children deal with their parents, or even adults with uncles or natural superiors, wives with husbands, vaishyas or kshatriyas with brahmanas, there's a whole ceremony that's involved in the proper way to behave, both going up the hierarchy and down the hierarchy. So Lewis mentions this. Milton delights in the ceremonious interchange of unequal courtesies with condescension, a beautiful word which we have spoiled. Condescension is the etiquette of a superior toward an inferior. Now the word is entirely in English, a bad word. Or you're condescending to me. It used to be, before in the olden days, the proper way to behave, the way a king or a queen would behave toward a subject, was called condescension. And you could read things like, somebody describing the visit of a royalty somewhere would say, everywhere she exhibited such beautiful condescension. You'll never see like that anymore, but that's the way it used to be. So he mentions this, with condescension on the one side and reverence on the other. You see, the ceremonious interchange of unequal courtesies. And he gives some instances of this from Paradise Lost. In Milton, in Shakespeare, it's in Dante. I mean, you go to the old literature of any European country, you'll find the same idea there. It was universal, and as we saw, it's also in Confucius, as far away as that, and of course it's in the Vedic literature. I mean, and you have to say, if you go back to anything that looks like civilization in the human period, this was the standard idea. There were local variations, of course, and it's the same idea we received from Srila Prabhupada. And it's only been gotten rid of, in the last few hundred years, really. And now, of course, we have a whole entirely different way of looking at things. And in fact, most of us, I still shudder when I think of this system. There's one part of me, I'm accepting it because it's given by Prabhupada and so on like that. But there's a certain reluctance that I have, and maybe most of us have, to follow this. And yet, here it is. I mean, if we accept the authority of Prabhupada, we accept the authority of the sages of the past, we accept the fact that the Vedas are not products of conditioned souls, what are we to do? You can't just... And this, for example, the part that's very troubling is getting us into trouble with the whole world more than anywhere else is the relationship between men and women as being a hierarchical one. If you want to say, well, let's get rid of that one and keep everything else intact, really it's part of a whole system. You know, it's very hard. You can't just make piecemeal adjustments to this picture of things, you know. So, why? What is the problem that we have with this conception? Why are we so reluctant, or why are we so adverse to accept? At least I am. When I see Prabhupada talking, first class man, second class man, third class man, fourth class man. You know, I just one part of me says, I wish he could find a more delicate way of putting it. It offends my democratic and republican sensibilities. I think the reason of this, our reluctance, well, first of all, there's a certain amount of propaganda, of course. I mean, we've just, certain ways of thinking are now in our blood. And when we see, like, for example, when I first began to have a good deal of experience in India, and I saw how people dealt with each other, especially in hierarchical family situations and things like that, one part of me couldn't stand it. And we have this problem in ISKCON, where we have a lot of Western people and a lot of Indian people in our conception of good manners. Western people, and especially American people, when we like to sit and talk to somebody about a problem, but we like to be honest and straightforward. We don't like to beat around the bush. We like to just, show our hand and say, this is what the problem is, and then let's deal with it. This is at least American, I suppose, to some extent European also. When we do that in India, we are considered rude beyond belief. And when an Indian is being showing so much politeness and etiquette to us, it looks like they're being so duplicitous and devious, and and they're not, you know, revealing their mind and so on like that. And a lot of times there's a lot of confusion because Indian people, especially the ones who come from rural backgrounds, and then maybe there's westernized ones from the cities, they just have this hierarchical thing. And if your father has done something that's shameful, you don't discuss it. He's still your father. He's your natural superior. Even though he's done something wrong, there's a very elaborate way of dealing with this. You don't confront him with it. You don't shame him in public. You find some other delicate manner of dealing with this particular problem. You don't lie that, you know, you don't pretend there's no problem. But your way of dealing with it is quite different from the way, you know, like in my country, you just finally confront the man and tell him to his face what he's doing and how everybody's all upset, you know. And but that's not the right way. Anyway, the reason that we find this uncomfortable, I think, and difficult, is that all our experience is of broken or fragmented hierarchies. Wherever now we have hierarchical relationships, they're fragmental. And if what Prabhupada tells us are right, there's no way you're going to get around these hierarchical relationships, because they are in fact there. They're there in reality. And when you pretend that they're not, then you get a social mess. But what we've seen is the perverted form of things. And because we've seen or experienced is the perverted form of things, therefore we reject the thing in itself. And that's our mistake. We haven't seen the real thing. This is what I can conclude from studying this. We haven't really seen the hierarchy the way it's supposed to be. And the way it's supposed to be, as Prabhupada tells it to us, stand up now, is that in the hierarchical relationship, the person above, in relation to the person below, has to represent God. And that's really, when that fails, then it becomes intolerable. It's very interesting that Prabhupada could come to America. Well, let me tell a story, actually. In my early days, as a devotee, I was out on the streets. I used to go to this certain corner and distribute Back to Godhead magazines. That's how long ago it was. And Back to Godhead was a street distribution instrument. I used to distribute Back to Godhead magazines all day long at the street corner, day after day after day. And I noticed there was one fellow watching me day after day after day with this kind of weird grin on his face, smile on his face, kind of a smug, superior smile. And finally he came up to me and he said, "You know, I admire you people and I really feel so sorry for you." He said, "I can see you're working so hard. I've never seen people work as hard as you have. And look at you, you're dressed in bed sheets." He said, "You have nothing to wear, you don't have anything." You're giving all everything you get to that man. He pointed a picture to Prabhupada. You're giving everything to that man. And he's riding around in big limousines and living in palaces. I really feel sorry for you. So I tried to explain to him that Prabhupada wasn't like that. And he just couldn't hear it. He just couldn't hear it. So I thought about this man, the reason why he couldn't, you know, understand this about Prabhupada. And then I realized that he actually had a hold of a truth. And when you see people sacrificing like that, the person at the top is the enjoyer. And that's what he understood, and he was right. His problem was he didn't understand that Prabhupada wasn't at the top, that Krishna was at the top. So I became Prabhupada's slave. You know, quite frankly, not to give ammunition to our enemies, but look up this word sometime in the Sanskrit dictionary. It means slave. It really does. We always say servant. Of course, we're voluntary, so it's not slavery. That's involuntary servitude. But anyway, we're Prabhupada's slaves, practically speaking, those of us. And yet, somehow or other, we didn't mind. We didn't feel lorded it over. We didn't feel exploited. And the reason was that it was very clear and apparent to everybody that Prabhupada was a better servant or slave than we were. He was the same as we. He was above us. He's our spiritual master. But to his spiritual master in the hierarchy, he was the same as we were to him. So the thing was that Prabhupada was not taking the place of God. Instead, he was representing God. Represent means to present over again, represent. So he was representing God. And so we didn't mind. We just didn't care at all. If we saw that Prabhupada had become the enjoyer and was exploiting us for his sense gratification, that if he had taken the place of God, then we would have said, no, this isn't right. So as far as I can see, we would have to go a little beyond Lewis and say that really the hierarchy holds up when everyone is the servant of Krishna. And then there's no problem. So we have our system. You know, if we look at this system, the social system, you know, brahmanas, kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras. Here it is. You know, each one is the superior. The other has to obey the one below it. And what do we see in modern terms when we have a class division? We have a social system with higher and lower. We have class or we have caste. You have exploitation, the lower, and you have envy on the other side. The lower wants to take the place of the higher. And this is our experience in the world. Every time you have these unequal relationships, there immediately appears exploitation and envy. The lower wants to rebel and take the place of the higher, and so on. So this is the real problem. I think of all our historical experience of hierarchy, oppression. So therefore you can say, for example, when people no longer represent God, then a very, very bad, unjust, evil situation arises. So there's absolutely no, you can completely understand, for example, why women do not wish to be submissive to men, for very, very good reason. They've done it, thanks. It's been tried, and it's been exploitation. People haven't been taken care of. People have been used, abused, and so on like that. So naturally, why should we do this anymore? Why should we accept this position? What happens to political leaders? You know, basically, we need to have political leaders. We've gotten rid of monarchy because every king is a tyrant by definition. And now we have a king or a monarch or a head of state that we can get rid of whenever we feel like it. But we're so afraid of exploitation that we would like to have these people solve all our problems. Usually we demand government solve our problems. But we are very reluctant to actually give government sufficient power to solve those problems, because we're convinced as soon as they have that power, they're going to misuse it. And so always there's a bind, please solve this problem, solve that problem, solve this problem. But as soon as someone wants the power, no, you can't have it. I'm sorry, you didn't solve our problem. Get rid of you, get the next guy in. And so everyone remains completely discontent with government, because we are afraid that anyone, we have the saying, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So the result of all these, what I would call fragments of hierarchies, like this cosmic chain is broken down. It broke, you know, God has disappeared. When Nietzsche talked about the death of God as an event in European cultural history, he was being, in one way, talking about our ideas of the world. When he said, God is dead, he goes on to talk about how the whole universe has crumbled. Because when Nietzsche was talking about God, he was not talking just about God, but he was talking about the whole order of the universe that was associated with that idea. And he said that the whole order of the universe has crumbled, it has fallen. And he could see before many people noticed that this had happened. So he says that, you know, the churches, they're just actually the tombs where God is buried. People don't even realize that they've murdered God, and they're not even up to the crime. If they're up to the crime, then they'd know what they were supposed to do, which is to become, now that the opportunity is there, to become God yourself. Has shattered and fallen apart, and therefore our historic experience, our personal experience, our experience in ISKCON has been everywhere that there has been power. And I want to say that devotees have not understood, although we are participating to some extent in a hierarchical society, the fact is no one has really understood the nature of this hierarchical society, because so many people in ISKCON also have become the victim of the main symptom of a broken hierarchy, and that is the abuse of power. We have ample experience of it in various places, where the people who are supposed to take care of, protect, be responsible for other people have, in fact, and therefore have power over them, sometimes naturally. I mean, a child actually has no choice whatsoever but to be under the control of the parents or of elders. So then there's abuse of power. And because abuse of power, because we've seen it in so many different ways, in the karmic world, within ISKCON, in history, we're ready to give up. Let's say, well, you know, there shouldn't be any more power. No, let's not have any power relationships anymore. Let's try to have a society in which there are no such things. What this does is just lets power loose without any controls or order, because there's always going to be weaker and there's going to be stronger. Let's turn to this other document that I've given you, which is Prabhupada's letter that he wrote to Sri Govinda on the topic of competition. I hope it's all here. Yeah. Sri Govinda was a temple president in Detroit, and there was a great deal of competition among the temples for book distribution, Chicago. Some people were upset about this competitive spirit because temples were getting quite envious of each other at certain times. So I don't know the letter that he wrote. So Prabhupada said, "Yes, there must always be competition. That gives life that cannot be separated from life. Sanatana Dharma means the strong will utilize the energy of the weak, and the weak must serve the strong. That we see everywhere, is it not? Who can deny?" So that competitive spirit makes us strong. Otherwise, it is a society of weak men only. And what is the good of such a society? So that's Prabhupada's first mention, that these unequal power relations are naturally there, everywhere. But now here's what Prabhupada says. "But if you ask anyone, are you weak or strong? Anybody, he must answer that he is weak. He cannot control even his toothache, not to speak of his death. Therefore, it is in fact, it is a society of weak men. Everyone is weak before Durga Devi, or the material energy. If you see sometimes her picture, the foolish materialist is being held by the claws of her tiger carrier. She's riding on a tiger, and the tiger has a forepaw down, and there's a little guy being crushed by this paw. You'll see him there, this little fellow. That's the foolish materialist. While she pierces him to death with her trident weapon. She's got 10 arms, each with weapons. So she is so strong, but we are so weak that simply by piercing with her trident, the threefold miseries, Adibhautika, Adidaivika, and Adiyatmika, the foolish materialists are all defeated. And before Krishna, Durga Devi is very weak." So, Krishna is the controller of Durga. So Krishna is the strongest. Satyam Sattvavatam Aham, I am the strength of the strong. Therefore, being weak, it is the eternal occupational duty of the living entity to surrender unto Krishna. That's all. In surrendering to Krishna, if everyone does it, still, the brahmanas will be served by the lower caste, the king will be served by the vaishyas and shudras, the vaishyas will be served by the shudras, the sudras will serve all the higher caste. There is still utilizing the weak by the strong, but feeling themselves always very much weak in comparison to Krishna, the whole society serves the strongest. Therefore, there will be no envy of the stronger by the weaker class of men. So perfect society, Vedic society, does not eliminate competition. Competition, stronger and weaker, must be there, but it eliminates envy, because everyone is weak before Krishna. Is that clear? So, that's the prescription. The problem is, you're going to have hierarchies, you're going to have stronger and weaker. But the point is, everyone has to understand who is actually strong. That is Krishna. Therefore, if the principle is the weak must serve the strong, everyone must be serving Krishna. So if I'm here and I'm serving this person, but I see this person is also not an enjoyer, that is a servant of Krishna, and he's serving this person who is also a servant of Krishna, who is serving this person who is servant of Krishna. And actually you'll find out that this ranking in terms of strong is really in terms of ability to be Krishna conscious and take responsibility for Krishna's service. So actually the service to Krishna increases as you go up. If that's actually working properly, then there should not be either exploitation, neither should there be any envy. As soon as the enjoying spirit is anywhere in there, you're going to have a problem. Somebody, what does the enjoying spirit mean? Somebody is forgetting, I am a servant of Krishna. Now I will take this energy, which is Krishna's energy for me to use, and now I'm going to enjoy for myself. I've become out of order and a thief. Then he goes on, regarding your other question, should we become detached from the results of our activities, or should we become simply attached to the lotus feet of Krishna? The answer is that both of these philosophies are right. One should not be attached to his personal achievement. If one is attached in order to please the spiritual master, then it is all right. Unattached to my benefit, attached to Krishna's benefit. Krishna consciousness means attachment for Krishna, detachment for personal benefit, that's all. And then he goes back to this theme. But in any case, if there is fight among yourself over these things, book distribution, competition, you should not develop ill feeling. That depends on the persons. If ill feeling is there, then stop it and altogether chant Hare Krishna. Those who are behind should utilize those who are advanced. If you become envious, that is material. Attachment, detachment, these things are natural. If you become attached to something, you become detached from the other. So we can estimate our advancement in this way. This is the test. In the Krishna consciousness movement, there is no question of enviousness, hatred, things like that. Material life means hatred for Krishna and desire for matter. So we have to convert ourselves. When one becomes Krishna conscious, actually he does not even hate material things because he becomes expert how to utilize everything for Krishna. Krishna consciousness is so nice. We do not hate anything material because we have learned from our disciplic succession how to utilize material things for Krishna service. Actually, bhakti means realization of the Supreme, and this means increasing attachment for him and reforming of detachment or hating of material name and fame. And there's another interesting paragraph that you can read for your enlightenment about lying and being truthful. When it's a little off our topic, so I won't go into it here. So anyway, this is the answer, I think, to if you're going to have a hierarchical society and it's going to work, there's just no substitute for doing this in a Krishna conscious way. If there's not Krishna consciousness, I don't see how it's going to be very effective, not going to be effective at all. It'll always be difficult, and there will be difficulty. But if actually there's Krishna consciousness, then there is no possibility of abuse of power. So then the next question is, of course, is Krishna consciousness possible? I suppose. I remember once Prabhupada had come to the visit. He had flown from South Africa or something to Vrindavan to the fairly recently opened Krishna Balaram temple. And when he got there, he found the management was a mess. And so Prabhupada was leading people on a tour and pointing out faults. And unfortunately, the temple president kept making excuses, which was the wrong thing to do at the time. So Prabhupada first pointed out that in the chandeliers up in front of the deities, there were bird's nests. And Prabhupada had given very specific instructions, you know, that one had to keep the birds from making. You know what happens is you get birds, first of all, I mean, then the birds, they pass stool on the people below and makes it. And so Prabhupada was very angry. I had to travel 7,000 miles just to tell you no bird's nests and so on. When then they were walking along, and Prabhupada noticed that the sidewalk tile was broken tile that they allowed themselves to be cheated by the supplier, who had obviously, you know, when in India you get a shipment of tile, stone tile, you have to check every tile. The first five will be nice, and after that they'll be cracked or something like that. So they were negligent, and so Prabhupada was pointing out that they had bought or been sold inferior tile that was cracked. So the temple president started to argue with Prabhupada, no, it's actually part of the design, it's supposed to be like that, you know. So Prabhupada was getting pretty angry, and finally they went to his room, and so Prabhupada was reviewing the things he found wrong one after another, and of course he... Gloom just settled on the assembly there as Prabhupada was going on. What's to be done? What's to be done? People would make different suggestions and Prabhupada would shoot them down. What's to be done? What's to be done? And finally somebody said, well, Prabhupada, I guess we'll just have to become Krishna conscious. Prabhupada said, another impractical suggestion. So, I hope it's not making an impractical suggestion. So I think tomorrow we'll go on and start talking about the possibilities of Krishna consciousness and at least how the system ought to work and what we can do about it. In the meantime, any questions? Yes, Maharaj, you had your hand up first. Not I'm calling on you because of your rank.
I wanted to ask you a question on competition. I have often heard that Srila Prabhupada only used what was there in us, that is a strong competitive nature. For instance, he incited his American disciples, who are Americans are considered to be the best of the competitors by genetic codex. He incited them and said, what is the use of you being American if you cannot do anything wonderful for Krishna? So, one view which I have heard expressed by Mike Vaishnava is that Prabhupada used this. And while he was present, he could bridle this very sometimes evil power of competition. Mm-hmm. But from what you have said, competition he had to use something which was already there, but that it is a natural thing because. According to Srila Prabhupada, or let us say the Vedic worldview which he represented, there is a natural order in the world anyway. Am I correct that this is your presentation?
Yes, that's right.
Good. Mm-hmm. Could you please maybe I'm too slow. I guess I'm too slow. Could you make it clear to me why competition has something to do with hierarchy? Isn't it that it is natural that the better one, or the one who's mm-hmm. more capable, that there's no need for him to compete with either the equal one mm-hmm. or with the lower one? So can you please explain the competition?
The way Prabhupada says here, he's almost using competition in two different senses here. By competition, when people compete with each other, that's one way of establishing who is strong and who is weak. Because whoever wins the competition, that is the stronger, and whoever loses, that is the weaker. So out of competition, there's always this conception of one competes in order to prove that I am better. But Prabhupada is saying, but this that there's better and there's worse is always going to be there. So he almost derives hierarchy that from the competitive spirit we see actually, even when people say we are all equal, still they're competing. And you get countries like America where everyone declares equality. The competition, the competitive spirit gets stronger and stronger. The more you say you're equal, the more everybody is working like hell to prove it's not the case. That I'm actually better than you. So that's what he's done in this way. So both things that you said are right. But in this thing, it seems to me like he just gives an analysis. What are the roots of competition? The roots of competition is that people actually know there's superior and inferior, and people are just trying to establish it. So actually, if it's recognized and acknowledged, then there actually wouldn't be necessity for this kind of competition. Still, everyone would want to excel in satisfying Krishna. That's natural. You do your best to satisfy Krishna. And in that case, Prabhupada also pointed out in this competition, if a person has done his best, then that person is the best. On whatever level that person is, you know, like the Hanuman, like the spider example in the Ramlila. A play like that. So that's my understanding of where this comes. It just shows that there is always going to be better, superior, inferior, and that's natural. But then there's something else was going on. He was trying to take the American competitive spirit and get more book distribution out of it. That's true. He didn't discourage it because it was based on something that's quite real. But he was trying to say that in any case, whether you have a hierarchical situation or you just have a bunch of people competing with each other, there's not supposed to be envy because everyone is serving Krishna. So whether I have a natural superior or whether I just lost and, you know, I've got a lower book score than everybody else, I should still not be envious of the people who have done better. Okay? Anyone else? Question? Yeah? Together with this equally strong sense that I am the spirit soul, I'm not the body, or what else is to say, I'm the servant of Krishna. That everyone is as being the servant of Krishna, which is the activity of the soul, the Sanatana Dharma. In that sense, everyone is equally the servant. That's based on the soul. everyone is on the body, their service is ranked like this. So if this gets on the bodily platform, naturally it's going to be. And of course, part of being on the bodily platform is then also lording it over, and so on like that. And it's quite true. When the thing, the whole system is connected with God, then it makes sense. If you disconnect it with God, then you can't figure out what it's there for. You know, you just think there are these nasty old guys, the patriarchs, you know, had all this vicious ideas and they imposed this system on us to maintain themselves in power. You know, it doesn't make any sense why it's even there anymore. But if self-realization is the goal of life, and your project is not sense gratification, then it all fits together quite nicely.
You're really just stuck here in this life. Like, this is
just
a woman's body, so this is the woman's stuff I do.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a king body, that's the king's stuff.
Yeah, nobody should take it all that seriously.
Right, exactly.
Neither the woman nor the king or anyone,
yeah.
Right. It's just the role you play.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's right. You have your place in the system, and you just do it with as much grace and as possible. Anything else?
Any philosophy that King Rahuga was hearing from Jadavara, from Jadavara?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I believe that's the essence of his philosophy.
Yes, it was. That's right. He was Jadavara was the bearer of the palanquin. Right. That's a nice one. Uh-huh. So now?
In Kali Yuga, are things just simply out of order, or in other words, do the parts that are there are not when someone's born, because you're born in Kali Yuga, it's not just that the king is out of order, the Shudra's not playing their role, but they have these, it's not so clear because they're almost like, brain damaged or organically unsound, people don't listen to how the cycle physically makes it.
Yeah, there's a lot of
clear. Mm-hmm. That's what makes me concerned.
Everybody tries to figure out, what's my varna, you know? It seems to be this weird mixture of the mode of goodness and the mode of ignorance and no passion.
Yeah, who knows what's happened? We're definitely in a really big mess, and because people have not been able to recognize these qualities and train people appropriately, then things have gotten quite confused. And all I can say is that I think it's going to take some time, a matter of generations actually, to get something like people who have a more clear sense of identity in these terms really functioning. I don't see it happening really fast. Yeah?
What is the effect of being, as you call,
servile?
Yes.
What's the effect of becoming servile?
Let me think about that. Servility, yeah, what is it?
It means you're not doing your duty.
Yeah, that's the one thing. You're not doing, you're obeying somebody you really shouldn't be obeying. And therefore, you're out of order. But I guess you mean what the psychological effects are? Or?
No, I mean in society.
In society. Yeah, that's it. You're not doing your duty. You're not in the right place. And you're taking directions or orders from somebody who ought not to be giving you directions or orders. And therefore, you'll be misdirected and misled.
Something about over-dependent or artificial dependence on others. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good point. As this is mentioned, that over-dependence or artificial dependence on others leads to degradation. Mm-hmm.
I think we have to stop you.
We do. Okay, you want to pop up and say something while you still have a captive audience? Don't move.
Can we ask if anybody still needs handouts?
How many people need handouts still yet?
That's me,
though. Oh, goodness. Look at this. Hold your hands up high. Who knows how to count? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 20.
20.
It's more than 20.
It's 25.
30.
Thank you. At 7:30 here in this room, we're having the ISKCON social convention, the first part, 3-day thing. It's only 1 hour because we're going to have a full day of things.